Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to Season 2 of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet.
Once again, Christina, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this. I always love to begin with origin story. So Christina, can you share a little bit about where your journey began and your relationship with the ocean began, whether it was during your childhood or later on? What was a moment that you remember distinctly, you know, setting the tone for how you would pursue this career that you're in currently and basically just the love that you have for the ocean? Where did that begin?
Well, there's probably a couple of points in time. First was when I was a very young child, probably age 4. My parents would take us to the ocean at Stimson Beach outside of San Francisco. And I was the one who would go charging into the waves and come running back and saying, "The ocean kissed me." That my brother would be digging sandcastles back on shore and run away from every wave that would come in. And we sort of evolved in that same direction. He became a geologist, and I, of course, became an ocean lawyer. But I went to law school sort of thinking I liked the history and the traditions of ocean law, space law. But after practicing in the private world of international maritime law, you know, where ships go, where they get arrested, and who has priority in mortgages, I was lucky enough to go scuba diving with my boyfriend in Palau. And because the weather was too rough for us to go snorkeling, which had been our intention, the guides just sort of said, "Oh, come on in. We can go 60 feet, 60 minutes, no problem." And I plunged on in fearlessly and full of fear, holding the guide's hand for the first time, but fell in love with the fish and the colorful corals and the various creatures that inhabit the reef. And this was after I had been working in a law firm for almost 3 years, had been feeling a little bit burnt out, but had enjoyed my work with NRDC in pro bono law on conservation aspects. So I was very happy to be able to make the transition through a fellowship up at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. They have a marine policy center there. So it was a perfect hideaway and also educational journey to be able to stay there for 2 years to work with the scientists who lived and worked and breathed the ocean, as well as to study international law and policies that could help to conserve the ocean.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I would like to dig a little bit more into that first dive in Palau. I've never been to Palau, but I'm curious to hear your perspective and your memory of what the reef looked like at the time that you went.
Oh, they were stunning. They were purple and pink and green and blue, various elements coming forward. They were filled with little and big giant clams that's filled with an amazing number of colorful fish, big sharks, even the humphead wrasse. This was in the early days. I would say when we were there, the first 747 jet plane arrived from Japan, and that introduced a whole new era of much more mass tourism. I wouldn't say it was massive. So in many ways, we were kind of the pioneers. It was Francis Terribion who had started the Fish and Fins tiny little shop, had traveled the world trying to learn how to teach scuba diving using the best available equipment they had. So it was a pioneering experience then. We were some of the first to go see the Jellyfish Lake in Palau, which is filled with these kind of evolved freshwater jellyfish that you can swim without really being affected by the many tentacles that sting you in the salt water.
That's incredible. Oh my goodness. Some days I think about what I would give to be able to see certain reefs around the world, however long ago, you know, just to be able to get a glimpse into what it was like in person. That's awesome. So when did you realize, based on your work as a lawyer and then transitioning to Woods Hole, was that the moment that you realized that you could contribute to protecting the ocean? And what skill sets did you realize in that moment that you needed to gain in order to make that type of impact?
Woods Hole was special because I could study with some of the scientists who were there. One, Fred Grassley, was teaching both tropical corals and deep sea coral biology. So I was able to learn ecology and biology from some of the leading experts. But what I realized I needed to know were sort of the domestic U.S. laws as well as international laws that could pertain to protecting coral reefs. So I actually taught myself all about the existing international environmental laws that related to everything from wetland protection to trade in endangered species to air pollution and the regulation of ships as they pass through the reefs. So this was involved with the early founding of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, where we also realized that you can do wonderful things by establishing a marine protected area, but unless you also address the water quality, and what goes into the marine protected area, you can soon be overwhelmed by outside influences. So it truly gave me a great foundation in sort of the need for ecosystem-based integrated coastal zone management that soon I was able to transfer out to the wider offshore waters beyond, within and beyond national boundaries.
When you talk about marine policy, I know that for myself personally, it's always kind of sticky, like trying to navigate specifically international laws and understanding how they work and what does it mean to be on the high seas. And when you go beyond, like you said, that national waters, the EEZ, exclusive economic zones of different nations, what happens out there? And from your education and what you learned at your time at Woods Hole to now, how have you seen those international laws transform and change?
Well, I guess I should backtrack a little bit. Part of my original focus was on tropical coral reefs. And then we moved to Poland, my husband and I, and was far away from the ocean. I was invited to a conference where they were talking about how to manage risks to the marine biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. And we had some scientists there and who had gotten some information and then some film from fishers in Norway about these amazing deep sea corals, cold water corals that could live at 4 degrees Celsius. And I became absolutely fascinated. And it became a quest to basically how to fill in the dark holes of ocean law. That's how to protect these vulnerable creatures that can live in our national waters, but also way beyond on seamounts and on raised areas beyond national jurisdiction. The biggest threat back then was deep sea bottom trawling. That was the Soviet Union and others had sort of started to scour the seamounts around the world saying, oh, there's all these lovely fish out there. So my education and first priority was really how do you regulate an unregulated industry that is known to be causing deliberate destruction to high seas biodiversity. So I worked with colleagues. I've always been sort of the quasi-academic. I sort of fall between a lot of different cracks because I'm not really in academia and I'm not a campaigner. But I do like to bring information together and network and people together. So I worked with some people from Greenpeace and we eventually established the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition to try to better protect these deep sea coral reefs. So looking at the international law of high seas fisheries, where they're talking about the need to regulate, to protect biodiversity in the marine environment, and then utilizing my contacts in Greenpeace and then Matt Gianni and the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, we're able to go to the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is responsible for all aspects of life on land and at sea, and sort of use the platforms of side events, which are an important tool for NGOs and scientists to be aware of, to bring information, to bring these videos about the deep sea and what things look like both before and after bottom trawling. And so by the time we finished just even one side event But I still recall clearly you had the scientists from Norway and the policy people from Norway and other countries saying, oh my God, I didn't realize it was so bad and so drastic. But then part of the trick is also probably to have people, some of your colleagues asking for far more than you will potentially be able to get. But what we got was not what we had hoped for, but we at least got basically a paradigm shift in international law, which in many ways is a far more profound change. It required fishing states as well as regional fisheries management organizations to make sure that they conducted prior assessments of the impacts of deep sea bottom fishing, did surveys, and then try to figure out what was the range of potential impacts, and then to manage the impacts of bottom fishing so to avoid significant adverse impacts. And then with experts in the fishing industry and governments, we actually defined what those significant adverse impacts might be. So you had a whole new precautionary thrust focus to high seas biodiversity conservation. But now what we've been trying to do since 2002 up to date is to actually make the same paradigm applicable to all activities in areas beyond national jurisdiction.
Wow. Wow. It sounds like a gargantuan effort to do that. And what are some of the mechanisms that you're using right now to achieve what you're hoping for?
Some of the mechanisms, well, they include lots and lots of science, lots of contact and interaction with scientists around the world. A part of what we've been able to do along the way is to help support and form things like the Global Ocean Biodiversity Initiative, which is various groups of scientists who are studying patterns of ocean life behavior across the high seas, whether it's highly migratory species, whales, dolphins, sea turtles, or even connectivity between hydrothermal vents. We also work with the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative, which is a group of mainly natural scientists with a passion for the deep ocean who decided they would like to see their science have a role in creation of policy, or at least in informing policy. So we work very closely with the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. And then I've also sort of been involved in trying to test international law by saying, how do you create a marine protected areas beyond national jurisdiction? So we also established the Sargasso Sea Alliance, which is now the Sargasso Sea Commission. So it's sort of like trying to match up or identifying that the science gaps, the experiential gaps, and you know, how does all this international law play together? And then I was also involved in the formation of the High Seas Alliance, which is the more activist arm. It's the NRDCs, the Greenpeace, the originally the World Wildlife Fund, as well as Pew and many other organizations who've come together to try to say this treaty that governments have agreed to negotiate between 2018 and hopefully end in 2022 is our top priority. So between Conservation International and Greenpeace and IUCN, we're able to cover the full spectrum of interactions with governments. As I said, you know, IUCN sort of sits in the back and sort of looks and provides ideas, and others are much more involved in organizing workshops with governments and helping to facilitate negotiations.
Wow. For everything that you just shared, it's evident that you are truly a connector. You're someone who knows how to bring the puzzle pieces together from different entities, different organizations, different scientific academic institutions. You know, it's, and that is a skill set in itself to be a connector. So in your opinion, what are some of those, I guess, soft skills that you may have learned along the way that have really benefited your work?
Well, what I try to encourage colleagues to do is to remain humble. Humility is important because none of us know everything and we're constantly learning. But it's also essential to find sort of that core feeling of confidence that you can do this. When you go out on a stage, yes, if you practice often enough, you won't make a total fool of yourself. That's to listen. We still are learning how to better listen to one another, but to try to get into somebody's shoes. In the early stages, Nancy Barron from Compass introduced something for us through the Pew Fellows program and said, you know, gear your messages to your different audiences. There are some who want to hear about economic problems. Others who want to hear about the aesthetics. What is the artistry of these amazing corals? Others want to hear about how this is going to advance their own national interests. And some want to see how they can create a legacy. So trying to create the dance between all these interests. And then, you know, the other soft skill is really just constant learning. I think I'm constantly trying to reach out to read the latest scientific articles that are way beyond my level of understanding, but actually saying there's a lot here and trying to build bridges.
Wonderful. And on that note, as far as like reading scientific papers, what other things are part of your daily experience? What does a normal workday look like for you?
Since we've been staying home during COVID, there's a little bit more normalcy. Part is communicating with colleagues. Part is catching up on the latest literature in science or political science. I've learned all about polycentricity and how governments get along with one another or don't, or the enabling conditions for it to happen. I'm right now writing an article or a report on thinking through next steps for implementing this high seas agreement. We've been negotiating it or discussing it now for 20 years. Given what we've already agreed and know will be part of it, how do we start galvanizing excitement about the next steps? I call it getting beyond yes. That was, and there are still some real difficulties with key issues in the negotiations. I am also trying to help finesse some of the letters that people are sending to governments to say, now is the time for high ambition. These are some of the core ingredients that should be part of it. And I just got back from Halifax, where I was part of a conference where they were talking about ocean frontiers and what are some of the nifty things that we could actually advance in the marine environment through new scientific discoveries and innovation. And then, of course, I'm there saying, we need environmental impact assessment. We need to make sure we understand the costs as well as any potential benefits of new technologies.
So let's talk about some obstacles. What hurdles did you have to overcome to be where you are today?
Well, we'll start with the hard part, which was when I was first practicing admiralty law, they still didn't admit women into the local club, the admiralty club in downtown Manhattan. And this was like the golf clubs where things got done. You went and met your colleagues, you sat around lunch, had a few drinks, and then you meet future clients, you align your deals and all these sorts of things. So women were pretty much still excluded from that world. I was never one to sort of let that bother me too much, but it could have been a true obstacle had I stuck around for a long time and wanted to make a career in maritime law. What I've learned, at least from back then, is that I had also had an interest in aerospace law. I wanted to be an astronaut, basically. I've always been torn between the bottom of the sea and outer space. And these newer fields were much more open to women. Other obstacles has been, well, lack of awareness, so lack of funding, that, you know, how do you actually get money to support a long-term, often hopeless-looking cause? That fortunately, there are a couple of funders, including the Pew Marine Fellows Program, that sort of believed in what I could do and what we could do as a collective. I was looking at the criteria for the Climate Youth Champions. And there, one of the criteria is for stubborn optimism. So I would say, you know, one of the solutions to some of these hurdles is that I'm sort of a cautious optimist, but also you need that stubborn sense of optimism that we can do better, we can do more, and that we can keep challenging ourselves and others to look towards the future and a better future.
I like that. Yeah. Stubborn optimism. It's required. It's required, especially in the times that we're living through right now. We have to know that we can do better no matter what. And if we don't have that, we don't have anything, right? We got to stay focused on what's possible. What can we build? What can we change? So I couldn't agree more. Wow. So what about triumphs? What major triumphs have you experienced in your career that are truly like hallmark moments for you that just gave you that extra, you know, nudge of confidence and even more courageousness to pursue what you're doing? What does that look like?
Well, that's a curious question because I've never really thought about that so much. The moments come in odd ways. That some of it is nurturing the graduate students that I teach and seeing them get launched in new roles of advancing, you know, this global plastics treaty. One of them did a lot of work on ghost gear and really helped to get an understanding of what some of the sources were and why it was difficult for fishermen to sometimes go after that gear or to store it or to repair it and actually trying to find some of the problems. Some of the triumphs, of course, at the United Nations when the governments finally agreed to launch negotiations back in 2017 and laid out the criteria going through. I mean, some of these meetings meant staying in the basements till late hours in the night to sort of help provide information and guidance, or even being locked outside the room and allowing the governments to go forward and then somehow having the trust that the committed ones are really going to stay firm. Going to large-scale international meetings, like we have the UN Ocean Conference coming up. I went to Rio Plus 20 back in 2012. And that was quite exciting because you really got to see governments going head to head on some of the critical ocean issues of the day and to meet some of the key negotiators and then see that the powers of persuasion of the people outside the room, the masses of people marching around saying, you know, we need the planet we want, you know, needs to be fixed and it needs to be put on the right path today, as well as the pressures inside the room. So I'd say that's another good example of a triumph when it all comes together.
Brilliant, brilliant. And you mentioned the students, the graduate students that you mentor. How has mentorship played a role in your choices and decisions throughout your career?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there was a woman at NRDC. When I went asking, what can you do in ocean law? How could you move forward? And she was very encouraging and welcoming. So I've always had a soft spot for NRDC, for Sarah Chasis, and for myself playing that mentoring role. I think it's a core responsibility. And now as I'm a little bit older, I sort of see it as essential to keep the, I won't say army, but the Navy, if you will, strong. That was in terms of understanding the ocean law, ocean policy, and the ocean science, because we need to be running full tilt on all fronts.
Oh, yeah. It's back to that connector role once again, connecting the dots between folks. And it's very necessary. So based on your experiences in the ocean, how do you think we can cultivate more ocean empathy on an individual level as well as a community level? I think that term ocean empathy has been kind of rising to the top lately because of this idea of caring not only for the ocean, but caring for each other. And like, how can we share more empathy for one another and all living beings on this planet? How do we do that? How do we cultivate more empathy for the ocean?
Well, I'll ask you that question next. I'd love to hear your ideas, but I think part of what you're doing is on the right track. I wish everybody could go and spend a summer by the seashore. That's that time playing in the waves, dancing in the waves, being on top of the water, sailing, surfing, snorkeling, scuba diving really helps to provide that sense of connection to the ocean. But even for those who aren't close to the sea, have access to lakes. And what I was interested in, there's a program in the Aspen Institute where they wanted people to have better relationships with the ocean, and they started by providing swimming lessons. And there are many people in small island states that are really terrified of the ocean. So trying to overcome that fear and to put on those goggles and being able to see what actually lies under the ocean surface is probably the first step towards ocean empathy. But also, I mean, amazing books and movies. I mean, Finding Nemo was great. That was the my octopus teacher, I think, was really a wonderful breath of salt air for our times when we've been locked inside during COVID. And then just listening in. I mean, there is an amazing number of webinars that are available. And what I get excited about is sort of telepresence, is that many ocean expeditions now have cameras that can guide you to the most gorgeous creatures in the deep sea and have scientists expressing their awe, their curiosity, and, you know, hopefully some glimmers of understanding, but discovery is really a magical moment. I mean, my favorite thing is really when they found the 150-foot siphonophore. That was this long sort of silly string looking thing in this ocean of azure blue off of Australia's Ningaloo Reef, that when you think about it, 150 feet of tiny little creatures, little like jellyfish nodules, but they do different things. Some propel, provide the movement, some do the reproduction, some go after the food, some actually steer and direct. And learning how these creatures communicate up and down this long spiraling thread is actually quite amazing and a wonderful metaphor for how we all need all of our different capacities and we need one another in order to keep ourselves aligned and going forward and basically to survive.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that you said you wanted to ask me that same question. And you mentioned the answer that I would have given in the beginning, which is access to swimming lessons and the ability to enter the water. It's a basic human right that I think every single human being should have access to around the world, especially in small island states or mighty island nations that I like to call. That's how I like to refer to them. My family's from Jamaica, so I can absolutely relate to the idea that generation after generation of people living in these islands don't know how to swim, including my own grandmother. And she never took the lesson. She decided not to, but she had a deep love for the sea, but also a very healthy fear of it as well. So how we conquer that is by experience and getting in the water and learning. In terms of the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, is there a line or a specific focus on just that? Providing swimming skills and lessons to people around the world?
I don't think there's a specific program on swimming, which it would be nice to start thinking about that. But I know there is a program on ocean literacy and various ways that you can actually expand public awareness about the amazing nature of the ocean. Thus, and perhaps I know Linwood Pendleton would be able to, or perhaps we'd be open to considering also those in-situ experiences that are such an important part. I mean, I remember I had to hold the hand, as I said, of my guide on my first scuba diving expeditions. Maybe we need to be able to do that. Not just swimming lessons, but how do you hold the hand or the rope or something behind you? But I really think being able to see into the water is such an important part. And, you know, as the 21st century mermaids, it really has to start with that comfort in the water and understanding how well it supports you if you sort of allow it to support you. That was the most blissful feeling, is just being able to lean back, look up at the sun and take in a deep breath and you float right up to the top.
That's such a great point. Yeah, that feeling is the best feeling. I love floating in the ocean. So yeah, when you think about mermaids, Christina, this is a fun question, but like we feature women who we believe are embodying the spirit of a modern mermaid. What is your interpretation of a mermaid?
Well, it's a delightful question. I would say it's someone who feels comfortable in the water and empowered by the water. I sort of often when I'm lying atop or floating on the water, I sort of think, well, thank you for supporting me. What can I do to support you? So maybe it's that feeling of reciprocal responsibility. We get so much from the ocean, and it's maybe a feeling that we get inside of ourselves of what can we give back.
Beautifully said. I love that. Yes. So what's next for you? And what are some of the ways that our listeners can support the Decade for Ocean Science for Sustainable Development? What do we need to do to contribute to help push the agenda forward?
Well, we need to push the agenda forward on multiple fronts. That's the UN Ocean Conference is coming up in Lisbon. That's where there's everything from marches by the youth across the streets of Lisbon that anybody who's close by could join, hopefully via train. That many delegations have been encouraged to include the youth voice on their actually as part of their delegation to attend some of the meetings. I would say the High Seas Alliance now has a group of youth ambassadors who will be in some of these high-level events speaking on behalf of generation that's younger than me. I'm still quite young, of course. But how can you actually get involved? Well, I would say the Ocean Decade has a way of getting activities and projects endorsed. And the idea of these larger projects and then individual activities is to be co-created, is to go out to your community, to go out to an array of disciplines. So yeah, they're not supposed to be our traditional single sector, single sex approach to solving all problems, but trying to be a collective gathering of information that applies to a particular challenge in the ocean. So it can be anything from organizing a beach cleanup. It can be hosting a TEDx event about the ocean and bringing that home. And the Ocean Decade now has a really nice website that lists the various endorsed projects and activities that are on there. There's also sort of a series of laboratories that you can participate in virtually and just sort of find out what is the latest thinking on transfer of science to policymaking. How do we create those interfaces that bring the scientists into the policymaking room, but where the policymakers listen to the scientists, but also the scientists listen to the policymakers, and what are the core issues and what's the sort of information and knowledge that we need to bring to be truly transformative.
And are there top three ocean policies currently being developed or on their way or maybe need public support that we can kind of look to and dive a little bit deeper into?
Well, one, the High Seas Alliance has a webpage that has ways that people can support the finalization of this new High Seas Treaty for Biodiversity Conservation beyond national jurisdiction. So I'd encourage people to start there. The other issue is a more tragic one, I think, is deep seabed mining. If people care about ocean life and integrity and the rights of nature, it's good to be aware that some companies and countries are trying to start a new industry, tearing up the deep sea floor in order to build so-called batteries for electric cars. And rather than trying to find new innovations to reduce our reliance on cobalt, they're just saying, we need to do the same old, same old. We've destroyed lots of areas on land. Let's go to the deep sea. There's fewer people out there to complain. So the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition has a very active website that's DSCC or Save the High Seas that people could inform themselves about and show their support there. If individuals who study deep sea science or policy or law want to get individually involved, the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative has multiple working groups on everything from fish to climate impacts to biodiversity, designing large-scale networks of marine protected areas. So that would be sort of the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative for budding experts, because there's a large focus on early career professionals, and High Seas Alliance and the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition for sort of more where multiple NGOs and IUCN have come together to try to support transformative governance opportunities.
Excellent. What a wealth of information. I love that. And those are all great launching points for people to get involved. So, Christina, I want to end with a vision. A lot of times, I think in our space, when we're all dealing with so many different issues and challenges that the ocean has to deal with, but we're trying to resolve at the same time, it can be a feeling of hopelessness and despair. But I wholeheartedly believe that if we continue to verbalize our vision of the future of what we want and what we need, the closer we'll be to getting there. So what is your vision of our ocean planet in 2030? If we could have it your way, the way that you think would allow the planet to thrive, what would it look like?
Well, the goal for the Convention on Biological Diversity, which they're currently discussing this post-2020 framework for biodiversity conservation, the ultimate goal is life in harmony with nature. The trouble is they're envisioning that for 2050. I would like to see that in 2030. That's where we've actually, designed comprehensive networks of marine protected areas where life can thrive, from our seagrasses to our sea turtles and whales, as also the jellyfish and plankton, to connected networks of other types of area-based management tools so ships can avoid whales when they're swimming outside marine protected areas, where activities are only permitted if they can show that they won't cause lasting impacts. That's that there's a requirement to actually show long-term sustainability, that you don't cause a loss of marine life or ecosystems, and that we learn truly how to channel our technologies into benign impacts, if any. That was, and then also, I mean, there's the real social component is we need to learn how to live in harmony with our ocean, live in harmony with nature. And that perhaps also requires enabling everybody to live in harmony with nature and with the ocean, is making sure that we're really focused on the equitable aspects of providing the resources needed to educate, to study, but also to get the basics for life. You know, everybody has a right to a healthy environment, and the environment has a right to thrive. I think, you know, sort of living inside of those two parameters. And then finally, I'd say some colleagues have developed this idea of the blue donut, is you have inside the circle are the social imperatives to allow people to take care of their basic needs, as well as their educational needs and their aesthetic needs and their philosophical needs. But then there's also the ceiling, the ecological boundaries that we dare not cross. Otherwise, we and next generations will be suffering the consequences. So we need to learn to drive and to perhaps swim within that channel between the floor that we don't want to go below and the ceiling that we don't want to go above. So we need to swim within that circle of life and find a way to recognize our connections and our obligations and our enjoyment of one another.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I could talk to you for hours. I love this. This is awesome. Christina, thank you for all this information. I've certainly learned quite a bit. And I hope that we can continue a conversation somewhere in the world at some ocean conference.
I sure hope so. And thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a real delight to be able to share and converse with you.
Thank you so much.
"21st Century Mermaids" is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.